And with that, we are at the top of the hour, so I would like to introduce our presenter today. Just one second. So presenting for us today, we have Dr. David Aaron. He is the director for the Clinical Program Research and Evaluation at the Lewis Strokes Cleveland VA Medical Center and a professor of medicine and epidemiology and biostatistics at the School of Medicine and an adjunct professor of organizational behavior at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. I'd like to thank him for joining us today. And with that, Dr. Aaron, I will turn it over to you now.
Well, greetings to everyone and all the ships at sea. I'm delighted to be presenting this. It turns out it's incredibly timely because a new consensus guideline came out, which pretty much goes exactly against what I'm going to talk about. I'll get to that later. The topic is balancing measures, and I'm speaking on behalf of not only my colleagues who are listed here, but all the folks who have been working on the hypoglycemia safety initiative in the VA for the past few years. So first, a disclaimer, what you're going to hear are my opinions, and plenty of them. You can see my various and sundry disclosures, and there is no collusion with Big Pharma whatsoever. I just thought you should be aware of that. And this particular presentation is rated R for opining and sarcasm, which may inadvertently seep in. Be discreet in your viewing, but feel free to challenge anything that I say. David.Aaron@va.gov. So here's the outline. I'm going to start with a cybernetic model of performance measurement, which sounds pretty bizarre on the face of it. Then follow up with some history of some performance measures in diabetes, unintended consequences, balancing measures, homeostasis, and some alternatives. I'm an endocrinologist by training, so this homeostasis and cybernetic model, is just part of my background. So here's a cybernetic system. It includes inputs, which are sensed, oddly enough, by a sensor. Some processes take place. There is an effector, which results in certain outputs. And what's key to a cybernetic system is that there is feedback. If you think about the beta cell of the pancreas, and since I'm talking about diabetes performance measures, what better to talk about than the beta cell of the pancreas? There's a glucose receptor on the beta cell, which is sensed. It is then, that signal is then translated into the production of insulin, which works on target organs. And maintains a certain level of blood glucose, which in turn feeds back. Okay, so this is a very simple closed loop system. This is what a normal person would do, and this is what we're trying to achieve in the ideal insulin pumps, a closed loop, although mostly what we have now is open loop systems. Well, if you expand that view, a key point here is the glucose is sensed, and that level has to be compared to something, and that's the set point. And based on the difference between the set point and what the sensor senses determines what happens at the effector level. And this is very similar to what's going on in your thermostat at home. You set the thermostat for a particular temperature. You can think about the cybernetic system of a physician responding to performance measurement. physicians have sensors. We get audited. We get feedback. There are things that we can do with our effectors, change medication, provide education, and so on. And what we do with that our effector is dependent upon the difference between what we sense and what the set point is. And you can think about a set point in this particular case as A1C as a measure for glycemic control. So there are really two key issues here. The first is how effective is the feedback? And the second is what about the set point? So we know that feedback is only modestly effective. Okay? And this is an example of clinical inertia. We sense that the A1C is too high. Forget about how we determine that or not. We sense that the A1C is high, and then we say to the patient, well, you know, let's try diet for a little longer or something else. But we don't change medication when medication is really indicated. And this is clinical inertia. And this clinical inertia can last for an awful long time. Now, I do want to point out that the date for this particular slide is 2004, which predates most of the diabetes performance measures. But lest you think that all is well in the world, let me show you some much more recent data from the Better Health Partnership, which is a Cuyahoga County-based initiative here in Cleveland. These are composite measures for diabetes care, and that includes an A1C less than 8% measure. You can see the percent meeting the standard on the y-axis and the reporting period up through 2016. And while there has been remarkable progress in reducing the disparities, now African Americans and Hispanics are just as bad as whites, but no worse, with the percent meeting standard stubbornly resistant around 50%. So something is getting in the way. So the set point. So we can think of the set point as a way to diagnose inadequate glycemic control. Now, if the set point is set too low, okay, for example, we want the A1C to be less than 6.5, okay, then we will overdiagnose inadequate glycemic control if you have an A1C of 6.6, okay, and that will lead to overtreatment. If you set the set point too high, then you underdiagnose inadequate glycemic control and you undertreat patients. So where does this set point come from? So here's a little history of the A1C less than 7 measure for diabetes. And this was proposed in 2004 by NCQA, and I'm quoting from some of their old material, that two comprehensive diabetes measures assess whether members with diabetes have their blood pressure controlled to 135 over 85 and whether their A1C levels are controlled to less than 7%, the nationally accepted standard. I put those in italics because it was not nationally accepted. It was just nationally accepted by those they chose to listen to. And the people they chose to listen to were those primarily coming from the American Diabetes Association, and was noted that this A1C less than 7 measure was in line with clinical guidelines established by the American Diabetes Association. And I would just like to point to Kasim's paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which rated the different guidelines from American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, American Association of Family Practitioners, American Diabetes Association, American Geriatric Society, and a couple from Canada and UK and the VA. And you can see that the VA's guidelines were rated much more highly than the ADA. Well, there was a national campaign, a national public service announcement campaign sponsored by the Conference of Mayors in partnership with AIM Believe Achieve, the Diabetes A1C Initiative trademark of Sanofi Aventis. And this is a screenshot. They've taken this website down, but thank goodness I copied it when it was still there. And it was actually Sanofi Aventis that paid for this particular thing. And further evidence for that is here's who actually ran the campaign. It was a very well-known public relations company, Burson Marsteller. Among their clients was Halliburton. You may remember them. And in the second paragraph, Aventis wanted to create an initiative to address the growing epidemic of uncontrolled diabetes. I won't tell you what Sanofi Aventis was marketing at the time. You can probably figure it out. So let's get back to our cybernetic system here. Okay, we've got our physician with the sensor and a comparator and effector. Working with the patient with diabetes to result in outcomes of interest. And let's say A1C is our target here. The set point is influenced not only by professional societies and guidelines and things like that, but it's also influenced by the quality measurement industry, which makes money based on coming up with guidelines, big pharma, patient advocacy groups, and payers. Just as an aside, I will tell you a story that when I was on the committee that came up with the measures for diabetes for the Better Health Partnership, and there was a lot of push, this was a number of years ago, to have an A1C less than 7 measure, and I fought it tooth and nail. And interestingly, the biggest push was coming with the members of the committee who were from the insurance companies. Interesting. So a whole variety of stakeholders come up with their idea of what is desired performance. That influences what the set point is. And with audit and feedback, that affects the physician. And we know that there are unintended consequences of performance measures, one of which, in terms of patient care, is inappropriate clinical care. Tunnel vision, you focus on one thing at the expense of everything else, or you just focus on one measure and make sure you meet that. And this is probably, I didn't make a slide, but this is probably a great time to mention Campbell's Law. Campbell's Law comes from Donald T. Campbell, a social scientist. He came up with this in 1976, and it states, the more any quantitative social indicator is used for social decision-making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures and the more apt it will be to distort and corrupt the social processes it is intended to monitor. Think about that. Well, could that happen? Well, one of the potential issues is if you have a measure where the set point is too low, you can overtreat people. And if you overtreat people with high risk of hypoglycemia, you are more likely to get hypoglycemia. You diagnose under treatment when the A1C is 7.1, you do something to lower the A1C, never mind that the coefficient of variance of A1C, coefficient of variation of A1C is somewhere between 2 and 6%. So an A1C of 7 could be anything from about 6.7 to 7.3, plus or minus. But putting that aside, you might overtreat and lead to hypoglycemia. This is exactly what happened. Hypoglycemia is a common side effect, especially with insulin and sulfonylureas, and in high-risk groups, and it leads to increases in hospitalizations. This graph shows data from Budnitz et al. On emergency hospitalizations for adverse drug events, and you will see that insulin and warfarin are at the top, and among oral agents, oral hypoglycemics and a couple of others are bad actors, and in data by Lipska et al. On national trends in hospital admissions for hypoglycemia and hypoglycemia, more people are getting hospitalized for hypoglycemia nowadays than for ketoacidosis, which was totally the opposite when I was a resident many moons ago. Well, with this increased frequency of hypoglycemia following promotion of intensive glycemic control, and that measure was A1C less than 7 for everyone aged 18 to 74, no exclusions. Was it a black swan? The answer is no. It should not have been a black swan. It should have been completely anticipated. Now, in response to a paper that Len Pogash and I wrote, Greg Paulson, who was the head of the scientific committee for MCQA, and Tom Lee wrote, "It is important to note that the National Committee for Quality Assurance includes a strong advisory that 100% performance is not the goal and that clinical judgment should be used in applying a measure." It sounds like they've actually never worked for a healthcare system, certainly not the VA, where anything less than 100 is a failure. To imply that clinicians would knowingly put patients in harm so they could perform marginally better than other physicians on a clinical performance measure provides a rather dim view of medical practice. Anyone who is a doctor probably has a dimmer view of medical practice than that. So what we decided to do was assess let's ask the question, who are the people who are at particularly high risk for overtreatment? Particularly high risk for hypoglycemia, where overtreatment would be a serious problem. And we focused on the rather well-known risk factors for hypoglycemia. Number one, taking insulin. Number two, taking sulfonylureas. Number three, taking both insulin and sulfonylureas. Number four, age greater than 75. Number five, chronic kidney disease, and a various other potential risk factors. And we looked at the amount of overtreatment, and it was rather extraordinary. Patients who met these criteria. Okay, and remember, they are all on insulin and or sulfonylureas, okay? Half of them had A1Cs less than 70. Now, if you're over age 75 and you're on insulin and a sulfonylurea with an A1C of less than 6, and about 10% of people had A1Cs less than 6, you're at real risk for falling, fracturing a hip, and so on. So this was really common, overtreatment, potential overtreatment. is really common. And I want to emphasize, these are people on insulin and sulfonylureas. We're not talking about metformin. We're not talking about diet-controlled diabetes. This is the kind of variation we see in the VA. These are facilities with greater than 100 patients with diabetes who met those criteria. You can see the networks. You can see in the darkest of the blue the percent of patients with A1Cs less than 6%. I mean, there's in network B, there are a couple of facilities where 20% of the patients had A1Cs less than 6. Pretty incredible. The A, B, and C there show facilities which had relatively low levels of overtreatment that were significantly different than the rest of their facilities in the networks. So potential positive deviance. Well, what happened to the A1C less than 7 measure? Those data, by the way, were 2009 data. Well, it was piloted in 2005, then it was initiated in 2006, and then the ACCORD trial was stopped prematurely because of increased mortality in the intensive treated group. And in 2008, NCQA discontinued its measure of A1C less than 7 for all patients with diabetes aged 18 to 74 and limited it to patients less than 65 with other exclusions in younger patients, coronary artery disease, and dementia, but A1C less than 7 is still marketed widely by others. This is something I pulled off the internet in September, and yesterday I got a copy, or maybe the day before, of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, who recommended an A1C less than 6.5% for everybody, saying that was optimal, of course, if it could be done safely. And in an affordable fashion. You might find it interesting to see what the big pharma connections are to the members of the consensus committee that came up with those. Well, meanwhile, back at the ranch, Choosing Wisely was initiated by the American Board of Internal Medicine, and among its lists of 5 things that we could stop doing, American Geriatric Society came up with one that said, avoid using medications to achieve hemoglobin A1C less than 7.5% in most adults age 65 and older. Moderate control is usually better. And reasonable targets would be 7 to 7.5% in healthy older adults with long life expectancy, and higher targets depending on life expectancy. If someone's not going to live for 6 more months, whether those 6 months are with a normal A1C or not is probably not particularly important. Coincidence with this was a national action plan to reduce adverse drug events sponsored by HHS, FDA, CMS, NIH, CDC, VA. And among the drugs that was focused on, and the top two were warfarin and drug-induced hypoglycemia. So let's just take a look at the evidence. We have ADVANCE, ACCORD, and VADT showed serious hypoglycemia, strongly associated with mortality. The association was strongest in the control arms, and I don't want to give anyone the impression that it is not just the A1C level, but it's also how you get there. The VA, in contrast to American Diabetes Association, has had stratified targets for A1C based upon comorbidities and presence of complications. If someone is already blind from retinopathy, keeping their A1C at an optimal level is not going to prevent further blindness. And you can see the American Diabetes and the American Geriatrics recommendations below. So there is some, disagreement here. And people can look at the same evidence and come up with different views. That there's nothing wrong with that, as long as we agree on what the actual evidence is. Well, in response to this, VA launched the Choosing Wisely Hypoglycemia Safety Initiative in 2014, a voluntary program, and what was made available to all facilities and individual practitioners were lists of patients at high risk for hypoglycemia, A1C less than 7 and on insulin or sulfonylureas who were age 75 or greater or had renal impairment with a creatinine greater than 2, and those at high risk who were demented. And any VISN site or any VISN or any facility, any individual doc could receive a variety of support materials which were available on the internet. Still are, by the way. So the data that I'm going to show you were funded by HSR&D Query. And if you're interested, this is really a sub-study that I'm going to talk about, but if you're interested in the grant itself, the actual grant, and the critiques, and I mean the real critiques of the initial submission, the concept paper, the revision, everything, and all the critiques, you can find them all in supplementary files in this article in Implementation Science. It makes for rather amusing reading. Once it was funded, it was a lot more amusing. So the two objectives were to determine the impact of the VA's initiative on overtreatment rates, and also to determine if there was an unintended consequence of an increase in undertreatment rates. So was focusing on overtreatment going to lead to less of an interest in undertreatment? So this was pre-test, post-test, using cross-sectional VHA data from calendar years 2013 and 2016. The patients met the same criteria that I've already discussed, and in 2013 there were 172,000 patients roughly, and in 2016, 167,000 patients roughly that met those criteria. Our outcome measures, the primary outcome was a rate of overtreatment defined as the proportions of patients in this group with A1C less than 7%. So it was consistent with American Geriatrics Association for the Choosing Wisely initiative. It's actually a little less stringent, and we also looked at secondary outcome measures, rates of A1C less than 6%, and as a measure of inadequate treatment, A1C greater than 9%, which has been the standard measure for many years. And here are the data. I have highlighted in red the and now I've just remembered after I've gone through almost all my slides that I can use the pointer. But if we just look at A1C less than 7, 40% had of these high-risk patients had A1Cs less than 7, which dropped modestly in 2016. 9% had A1Cs less than 6, which also dropped a tad. And with paired t-tests, these are all significant at a fairly high level, but that's not difficult to do when you've got 170,000 patients. A1C greater than 9% actually rose a little bit. And you could see that they're very wide facility ranges, very wide. We then looked at the correlation between overtreatment and undertreatment, and it was an inverse correlation. So the more people who were undertreated, the higher the overtreated. And that we also looked at the percent changes, the absolute changes, which are also inversely correlated and highly statistically significant. And because there were, you know, considerable baseline differences, we looked at the relative year-to-year changes, and those were also highly correlated. So this is what it looks like. And I have made rather elaborate X and Y axes tiles. So basically you want to be in the green area, which is here. This is lower overtreatment and lower undertreatment. Okay? This is lower undertreatment and higher overtreatment. This is higher undertreatment and higher overtreatment. You really don't want to be here. And this is lower overtreatment and higher undertreatment. Okay? But what you see is this correlation, which is statistically significant. And here's looking at the relative change, it's equally significant. In other words, the more you overtreat, the more you undertreat. So what's going on? Well, promotion of undertreatment, overtreatment reduction may be associated with an increase in undertreatment in patients with diabetes. And this is a simplified, double cybernetic model, where if you focus on one, focus on overtreatment, you ignore undertreatment, which leads to increased undertreatment, which then you may find you're getting beaten on to focus on undertreatment and then ignore overtreatment and so on. Now, for the limitations, the VA, of course, is a single healthcare system, albeit a particularly large one. Pre-test, post-test design is susceptible to changes in secular trends, and all the forces affecting over- and under-treatment rates in the VA could differ from those in the private sector. And the magnitude of the changes is modest, and the statistical significance may exceed the clinical significance. Now, this idea of balancing measures is nothing new. This is what homeostasis is all about. And if we go back to the pancreas, we not only have beta cells, which respond to high glucose, we have alpha cells, which make glucagon, that respond to low glucose to maintain glucose level within a range. So these are, homeostasis is a tendency towards a relatively stable equilibrium between interdependent elements. So this is perfectly nice. So balancing measures is something to think about. An alternative measure is to think about keeping an A1C within a range. So think about anticoagulation. Ideally, we want the INR to be within a particular range. We don't want it to be too low where the patient has an increased risk of clotting. We don't want it too high where the patient is at increased risk of bleeding. You want it to be, you know, just right. So when Pogash and the rest of us came up with this in-range and out-of-range measure, the in-range would be between 7.5 and 8.5, and out-of-range would be a combination of less than 7 and greater than 9. And remember, these various measures are going to apply to particular people. If we've got a newly diagnosed young type 1 diabetic with a long life ahead of her, we want to keep her, we want her to maintain an A1C that is as basically as close to normal as it can be safely done. And if we ever get to closed loop systems, we might be able to keep it absolutely normal. So we proposed this as well. It has not taken off, to say the least. And as I end here, being in my advancing years, this has been quite a long quest for Len Pogash and me to try to bring some reason to the use of performance measures. And we talked about balancing measures 8 years ago now, and have been sailing against the wind for a long time. But it has definitely been quite an interesting quest. So in summary, actions have consequences, both intended and unintended. And parenthetically, the unintended consequences are not always bad. They may actually be good. I just present an example of one that was bad. The implementation of an improvement initiative or performance measure are actions. When adverse unintended consequences can be anticipated, and I think these could have been, it is incumbent upon systems to include mitigating actions, such as counterbalancing measures, to ensure that unintended harms are avoided. And I cannot help but tell a little story about when I met the person who was, I believe he was the scientific director at NCQA at the time. This was before Greg Paulson. And I was at a meeting, and the A1C less than 7 measure had been out for, maybe 6 months or so by then. And I went up to him, and I asked him, you know, have there been any problems with patients getting hypoglycemic? And he said, no problems at all. I said, that is fantastic. How are you measuring it? Oh, we're not. Okay. Well, you know, if you don't look for it, you're certainly not going to find it. I don't think this was a black swan. I'll leave the slide for those who like to download slides to show all the various ways that that the value of performance measurement can just leak away. And we do this really well in the VA, I must say. But the bottom line, it is easy to dodge our responsibilities, but we cannot dodge the consequence of dodging our responsibilities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aaron. Pardon me.
By now it should be Dave, don't you think?
Sounds good. We do have time for some Q&A with the audience. For those of you that joined us after the top of the hour, to submit your questions or comments, just go to the GoToWebinar control panel on the right-hand side of your screen and click the arrow next to the word questions, and that will open up the dialog box for you, and then you can submit your questions or comments there. And the one person wrote in, I'd like the references to this, thank you, and that actually is included in the slide deck. It's the last slide after this one, so you can go ahead and download a copy of today's slides, and you will find all the references there. Another person wrote in, do we have access to the slides to this presentation? Once again, yes, you do have access to that. Oh, David, we can still see your screen, actually.
You can hold off on that until
the end. Thank you.
Just so you see the feedback I'm getting.
Excellent.
It doesn't hurt that I was his attending when he was an intern.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, that's not the funniest thing we've had pop up on the screen, so you've got that. I'm sorry. So one of our attendees wrote in saying, do we have access to the slide presentations? Yes, we do. You can download those. There is a link in your reminder email that you received this morning, and also you can also wait for the follow-up email that will show up 2 days from now, and that will have a link to the recording as well as to the slides. We do have several
I should mention that the Hypoglycemia Safety Initiative materials, which are available to be downloaded, can be found on the VA's Quality, Safety, and Value website, and it's on the internet, so it's open to everybody. And you'll see there are materials that are directed towards clinicians and materials directed towards patients as well.
Thank you. We have several people that wrote in saying they very much appreciate this presentation as well as the sense of humor you were able to bring to it, so thank you for that.
Just remember that life is much too long not to have fun, because if you're not having fun, you're not having it for a long time.
That's a good one. I might keep that one. The first question that came in, unintended consequence are medical groups that are treating veterans, Medicare patients, privately insured patients, and others who are being, quote, graded on meeting multiple metrics on DM control. How do we manage that chaos?
Yeah, that is both a great and a really tough question. We have found that, at least in the patients here in Cleveland, so we identify patients who are at high risk and try to do something about it. The ones in whom it's very, very difficult to do anything about it are those who have another provider outside the system. And it may be the metrics, but it may also be that, you know, doctors have been brought up to believe that tight control is everything. So I wouldn't solely blame the measures. I think the measures are certainly contributing. It's extremely difficult. Fundamentally, it comes down to shared decision-making and spending time with a patient and empowering the patient to go back to their primary care outside the VA and tell them they don't really want to have the risk of falling down and breaking their hips. But it's very, very difficult. If there were a simple solution to that, word would have gotten around by now.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, Dave, why were insurance companies so keen on more aggressive A1C targets?
Well, I tried to find out why. And I didn't. Apart from the fact that they believed it, and these were both docs who were working for insurance companies, my guess is that insurance companies wanted to be able to demonstrate their value to the payers. And by having a more stringent measure, they could beat on the docs more effectively. That's my guess, but it is only a guess. If anyone has a better explanation, I'd really like to hear it.
Thank you. How is clinical significance of difference in percentages estimated compared to statistical significance?
How is clinical significance? gets. Well, that's
a good question.
That's a very, very general question. So, there are a couple of issues here. And the first is a measurement issue. So let's say, is there a statistically significant difference between 100,000 patients who have an A1C of 7.3 and 100,000 patients who have an A1C of 7.1. Okay? All right. Well, let's assume, just for the sake of argument, there's a statistical difference. Is 0.2 A1C a clinically significant difference? Well, 0.2 A1C is within the measurement error for most A1C lab tests. So part of the way of determining clinical significance is based on the coefficient of variation and how much difference it is relative to the coefficient of variation. A lot more is based on clinical judgment, quite frankly, as much as anything else.
Thank you. The next question, what are your concerns with all the different DM medications available now?
Well, you know, I remember when I was a medical student, we were taught always use the newest medications before they've had any had a chance to have any side effects. So I am a bit old-fashioned. I would like to see that drugs have been safe over some long term before I am willing to adopt them routinely. I am very hopeful that some of these newer agents, which have a very low risk of hypoglycemia, which is great, will turn out to be very safe. I am hopeful, but I'm still waiting for the evidence. We don't have 10 years of experience with many of these drugs.
Thank you.
Another issue that we don't really talk about much is because we talk about diabetes as if that's the only thing the patient has. That's usually one of three or four or five things that the patient has. So it's not only the diabetes medications we have to think of. We have to think of the interactions between those medications and the other medications they're taking, as well as issues related to adherence, especially with polypharmacy, and medication error. As a general rule, the less medications that I can use, the happier I am.
Thank you. Dave, is VA more or less tunnel vision about performance measure than private sector healthcare organizations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they all are to some degree. I guess it's what is the light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, at our university affiliates, the light at the end of the tunnel is RVUs. But the VA, I think, tends to have more tunnel vision, and that is politically inspired.
Thank you.
I think one of the reasons why the Choosing Wisely initiative in the VA had so little impact is because of Phoenix. And everyone is focused on access. And that's the only thing we talk about. And it's not that access is bad, but access is only one thing.
Thank you. What would be the most practical clinical solution for frontline providers to balance the risk for over and under treatment? A reminder in the EMR, or would this be ignored?
Well, I can tell you that the experience in Network 12, starting out at TOMA. So this actually started by one primary care doc in TOMA who was really unhappy over treating patients. And he really came up with this initiative and developed a clinical reminder that included stratified targets, lists of patients who met criteria for over-treatment, and so on. And it was used. And there have been a number of networks, and these tools are available, okay, and there have been a number of networks that have chosen to use those. Would they be ignored? Probably depends upon how many other clinical reminders. You know, the death by a thousand clicks kind of thing.
Thank you. How do we get away from one-size-fits-all metrics? You shared decision-making. Your shared decision-making cannot be quantitated by computers.
Well, that is only partly true. One measure that might be reasonable, and this is actually built into the clinical reminder, is that the patient has an agreed-upon A1C target. So the quality is based on the degree to which you achieve that target.
Thank you. Thank you for the great.
I should also mention that there are, you know, the VA has had stratified targets since 2000, which have been, I think, systematically ignored by everybody outside the VA and to a large extent inside the VA. And those targets could probably be operationalized. But does everything have to be assessed by computer? Is that what we've come to?
Thank you. Thanks for a great talk. How do you stratify performance measures based on age and comorbidities in VA so that primary care providers don't get penalized?
Before I answer that, I want to mention the name of the internist who started all this stuff, and his name is Mark McConnell, and he works at now he's at Iron Mountain VA, but he is my hero. So let's get to how can you address the issues of comorbidities. There's some pretty good guidelines within the VA's guidelines of how to do that. Now, it takes time to operationalize those, but I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility to do that. I think it's probably more practical to focus on the extremes. So, you know, basically A1C greater than 9 is not good for anyone. That's a pretty good measure. Okay, that's very reasonable, okay, because you could even be symptomatic. So even if you have a short life expectancy, getting up at night to urinate because of hyperglycemia is probably not a great thing. Then we could pick out individual populations. I think we have to be much more sophisticated about how we use performance measures instead of this one-size-fits-all, which has been a problem. That is the easy solution, but H.L. Mencken was misquoted, actually, or this is a misattribution, but he said there is a simple answer to every complex problem, and it's wrong. Well, most simple answers turn out to be wrong when you have a complex problem like this one.
Thank you. And as follow-up, they asked, how can a PCP not get penalized when they leave a percentage of their panelists with an A1C over 8%?
Well, you know, right now in the VA, there really is only one measure. There's only one official measure, and that's A1C greater than 9. I know that individual facilities choose to use other things, like A1C less than 7 or A1C less than 8, but I don't believe that there's an official measure for that. And, you know, maybe something has happened recently I'm wrong. So this is a facility issue. And I am very mindful of these facility issues. So when this goes way back to the beginning of performance measurement, for hypertension, we're going to put in a clinical reminder for blood pressure less than 140 over 90. Okay, not bad. That's actually what the measure was. But a primary care person wanted it to be 130 over 80 because if it was 140 over 90 and people were a little bit above, they'd ignore it. Never mind whether 130 over 80 was appropriate or not or was overtreatment or not. So, I mean, facilities do... People in facilities do interesting things, and it's basically a political fight as much as it is a fight about evidence.
Thank you. Two pending questions. I am a diabetes educator. At my VA, I have a very difficult time finding documentation of the veteran's target A1C. How can we better share this information?
Well, what we do here in Cleveland is we have a diabetes note template where that's part of it. So that's probably the easiest way to do it, although, you know, docs have to want to do it. I mean, all these things take time, and in an era where time is limited, which is to say any era, and there's pressure on access, you know, time spent with one patient is time not spent with making oneself available to another. But I think using a note template is probably the easiest way to do it. And God bless diabetes educators. We would be nowhere here in Cleveland without them. They are absolutely, absolutely essential. I think we have 26 people who have gone to get certified diabetes educator status. They're not all doing diabetes education, but it's really important.
Thank you. One person wrote in response, in every consult that I provide, we quote individualized goal for that particular patient, and that helps the PCP a great deal. Thank you, that commenter. And
couldn't support that more.
The final question, is VA considering that quality measures as external motivators may actually be decreasing intrinsic motivation of clinicians to provide the best care?
God forbid. I'm laughing when I say that. I think there's pretty good evidence that these extrinsic motivators are damaging intrinsic motivation, and I certainly worry about it a lot. Do I think those at the top worry about it? Who knows? I'm nowhere near the top.
Thank you.
You know, sometimes sometimes it's really good to be old.
That is the final pending question. Do you have any concluding comments or a takeaway message you'd like to leave our audience with?
Yes. I am going to quote, so in my clinic, I have three rules. They're in Latin, so bear with me. Primum non nocere, first do no harm. Secundum cognoscere, second, learn. And third, tertium, habere fun. Third is have fun. If we do those three things, we will be able to sustain ourselves as healthcare professionals. And I recognize that it ain't easy. But don't lose focus of that, of those three.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on and lending your expertise to the field. And thank you to Christine Kowalski and Nick Bowersox for organizing this and all of our query cyber seminars, which generally take place on the first Thursday of every month at noon Eastern, so keep an eye out in your email. Thank you to all of our attendees for joining us today. I am going to close out the session now, and for our attendees, please wait just a second while the feedback survey populates on your screen and take just a moment to answer those few questions. We do look closely at your responses, and it helps us to continuously improve our presentations as well as the program as a whole. Once again, thank
and
you,
David. I would like to say that if you have any suggestions to me about how I can make this presentation better the next time I do something like this, my email should be on the screen. Please send them to me. I take quality improvement very personally.
Excellent. Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you again, Dave, and everybody have a great rest of the day. Bye-bye.